the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Psalm 145, this is page 602, and we'll read from verse 8. It says this: "The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and rich in love. The Lord is good to all. He has compassion on all he has made. All your works praise you, Lord. Your faithful people extol you. They tell of the glory of your kingdom and speak of your might, so that all people may know of your mighty acts and the glorious splendor of your kingdom. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and your dominion endures through all generations. The Lord is trustworthy in all he promises and faithful in all he does. The Lord upholds all who fall and lifts up all who are bowed down. The eyes of all look to you, and you give them their food at the proper time. You open your hand and satisfy the desires of every living thing." And the next psalm takes up the same theme in verse 5. "Blessed are those whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord their God. He is the maker of heaven and earth, the sea, and everything in them. He remains faithful forever. He upholds the cause of the oppressed and gives food to the hungry. The Lord sets prisoners free. The Lord gives sight to the blind. The Lord lifts up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord watches over the foreigner and sustains the fatherless and the widow. But he frustrates the ways of the wicked." Does God care? Let's have a look at some of the things that people say nowadays.
How do you know that God cares about you?
I don't know. One day yes, another no. Please leave me alone.
I know. Because I'm a successful businessman, and I have a restaurant down the corner who's very busy. So I guess, you know, God help me out. Give me good business.
I don't know. I would guess blessing me with the things.
Well, I'm still alive. Just letting me live, letting me do the things that I want to do.
Well, the way things go in life, if they go good, then he cares about you. If they go bad, then he doesn't care about you.
How do I know that God cares about me?
I don't know, man.
I guess because he created it, and when you create things, you care about them.
I have no clue.
I don't know.
It's just a feeling.
How do you know that God cares about you?
I don't even know, but I'm going to go around the corner. You call him back, man. You call him back.
I'm very busy, Colin.
Sorry. I guess I'm going to hell. Sorry, buddy.
Oh, I can't answer.
I wake up every day.
Wake me up every morning.
How do you know that God cares about you?
You don't know. First of all, you got to believe there is a God. And if you believe that, then you just go on faith.
What about you?
Go on faith.
I'm not sure that God exists.
No clue. Not really very religious, actually.
I don't know if he is or not. I'm an agnostic.
First, I have to see him.
How do you know that God cares about you?
Lost for Words is the title of this series. And that gives us our next problem, doesn't it? The Bible claims everywhere that God really does care. It assumes it from cover to cover. Lots of people living nowadays assume that you can't really know. You can't be sure. If there is a God, does he care? Lots of people in our society would say God doesn't care. And the new atheists, the people who are writing books criticizing Christianity, hostile to religion these days, would say God almost certainly doesn't. And I think the attack comes in three areas. And we're going to have a look at these three areas and work out what we could say when we get attacks in these areas. First of all, God doesn't care in daily life. There are plenty of people who said, I tried it, but he let me down. He doesn't care. I didn't find the loving God you Christians talk about. It must be fantasy. It must be a fairy tale because it never actually happened to me. That's a fairly small and trivial one in some ways, although we'll have a look at it to start with. But a more important one, really the $64,000 question for lots of people today about faith in God, is God doesn't care in times of suffering. Where is God when there is heartbreak around? Where is God when there's a tsunami? When there's an earthquake? When a plane goes down in the ocean? Where is God when normal people suffer? When you look at the pain and hurt and misery of the world, how can you possibly talk about a loving, caring God? It's a sick joke. And because that's a serious one, that will probably take the bulk of our time, I reckon. But if we've got time, we'll sneak in another one as well, which is God doesn't care in the end. In the end, he'll send the majority of his creation to hell. Robert Burns talked about God as the one who sends eight to heaven and nine to hell for his gained pleasure. And if God really is like that, if God really does believe in hell as much as people believe he does, then how can you talk about a caring God? So, we're going to have a look tonight at what you can say to people when you get one of these three areas of attack. We'll do it as before. We'll get you actually doing something and working. So you need to be close enough to two or three other people, I guess, to do some thinking together for a minute. Let's start with that first one. God doesn't care in daily life. You'll find lots of people say, well, I tried. I've tried being a Christian. I've tried believing in God. I've tried praying. But I know God doesn't care because of certain things. And here's a list of one or two that I came up with. It doesn't feel. He doesn't feel as if he's there. I have no sense he's there with me. When I go out into the street on a Monday morning, how do I know that God is there with me? I don't. I don't feel any different. God doesn't feel as if he's there. Second, I don't believe he cares because he didn't give me what I prayed for. I asked again and again and again. Did it happen? No, the sky stayed silent. Therefore, I know God doesn't care in daily life. I know God doesn't care because he hasn't changed me. I have a problem. I have a besetting temptation. I have something I desperately need his help to get over. And does he help me? No, he doesn't. Nothing happens. It's the same as it always was. I know God doesn't care, number four, because he doesn't speak out and guide me. I need to know where I'm going with my life. I need to know how to make the big decisions. But for all the promises in the Bible about he'll guide you in the way that you go, he'll show you his perfect plan for your life, he doesn't do that. And I have no sense that there's any guidance going on out there at all. And I know that God doesn't care because I had a problem and God didn't save me. He let me go right through it. Things turned out disastrously. I lost my job. My marriage did end. My mother did die. Whatever it was, God did not intervene. He did nothing about it. So I know that God can't really be there or can't care if he is. I know that God doesn't care, final one, because he hasn't made life any easier. He's made life no easier for me. I thought becoming a Christian was supposed to bring you abundant life. Preachers talk about love and joy and peace, and it sounds fantastic. That has not been my experience, so God doesn't care. Now, when people say that to you, what do you answer? What I'd like you to do is, in a small group of however many people you feel happy with, and if you don't feel happy with any of them, feel free to do this in splendid isolation, but you'll probably miss out on the good ideas of others. What I would like you to do is just look at that list and discuss together, which of those have you come across people actually saying in the past, or do you feel might be fair in your own experience? And can you think of maybe just one or two of them that you could think of some answers to? Let's take 5 minutes to do that then, shall we? And then we'll get back together and just discuss what you've thought. Does that make sense? Is it clear? I'm glad you said that. Let's do it. Okay, let's look at what we've got then, shall we? Let's look at the list we have here. And let's just do a show of hands to start with. He doesn't feel as if he's there. How many people have heard that kind of objection before now? Quite a few of us. Did anybody come up with a good answer to that one? Things that you would say to somebody in that situation? Okay, that's fair enough. He didn't give me what I prayed for. How many people have come up against that one? Any answers? No is also an answer. That's absolutely right, isn't it? Just because God doesn't give you what you think you need does not mean that it's necessarily what you really, really needed. It may well be something quite different. And the Bible does say, trust in the Lord and he'll give you the desires of your heart. But that doesn't mean everything you set your heart on, as it were. The heart in the Bible is the engine room of your personality, the center of who you really are. And sometimes the things we think we want are not the things that are our deepest desires, that we really, really need for fulfillment. And sometimes God says no to the candy floss, superficial things. That's absolutely true. So there's a start of an answer there anyway. Not that we're going into these things in any depth. He hasn't changed me. How many people have come up against that one? One or two, but not too many. Have we got any good answers if you do? Oh, sorry? Yeah. Yeah. That can help in some cases, can't it? In others, it just depends on the situation of the person concerned. If it's somebody who's fairly flippant and, oh, I tried it, it didn't work, then that might well be a very good answer. If it's somebody who really has a serious problem because they think, well, it just feels like God has let me down, and it's not just to say, well, it works for other people, might just make them feel a little bit more desperate. But certainly it's true that it's in seeing other people and catching their style and being with them that you start to find answers and find out what you're doing wrong and why you're looking in the wrong place for the help that God is desperate to give, but you're missing out on in some kind of a way. And sometimes, too, changes take longer than we're prepared to give, don't they? But we'll come back to that. He doesn't speak out and guide me. How many people have come across this? Problems with guidance that have said, made people say, oh, nothing really happens. Well, what would you say to somebody in that situation? One or two people have come up against that one. It is a problem, isn't it? Guidance from God, knowing when God is speaking and when he's not. So how about somebody who says, well, it seems to be make-believe because he's just not guiding me. Say again. Right, okay, yes, and as Mark Twain once said, gives me problems is not the 90% of God's will that I do understand, the 10% of God's will that I don't understand, it's the 90% of his will that I do understand and don't want to do. And that's absolutely right, isn't it? God has said most things. And why should God tell you anything else if you're resisting at some point? Often, God doesn't reveal his will to us because we're not right with him. We're not doing what he's already said. And if you're not doing something already, why should he continue to speak to you? And there are lots of answers along those lines. There's lots more, isn't there? He didn't save me from my problem. I had a problem and a difficulty and God let me go right through it. How many people have come up against that one? Quite a few. And what would we say? What would we say? Absolutely. If God made life artificially smooth all the time, we'd never learn anything. We'd never develop in any way whatsoever. Sometimes it's only through the hard times that we can learn. And so the reaction to a problem should not be, oh, God's let me down again, but rather, what is God trying to teach me through this? Is there a meaning? Is there a purpose in this? And if I can't see a meaning or a purpose, is God capable of bringing something out of it that will be constructive and will be worthwhile? Absolutely right. Good. He hasn't made life any easier, is the last one. How many people have come up against this one? Tried Christianity, didn't work. Love, joy, peace, forget it. Moonshine. You haven't? Oh, I've come up against it quite a bit. What would you say anyway if you met somebody in that situation? God doesn't necessarily make it easy for us, does he? And he never promises that. He did promise us a full life. He promised us a rich life. But sometimes that way lies through suffering and difficulty too. And we need to be prepared for that. We need to be prepared for whatever he's going to give us, whether it's good as we see it or bad as we see it. Nonetheless, we've got to be prepared to say like Job did, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. Whatever happens is coming from the hand of God to us, and he's got things to show us through it. So the idea that becoming a Christian sort of adds a super dimension to your life that makes it nice and working is a dangerous, dangerous thing. And in general, we haven't got time to talk about all of these things, but I think we get these problems thrown up again and again because, first of all, we live in a feelings-based culture where people expect things to feel right. And if they don't feel right, then you move on. That's why so many marriages break up, isn't it? The spark is gone. The chemistry isn't there between us. We have different needs now. We've grown apart. It's easy to rationalize going back on a commitment by those kinds of feelings-based arguments. God never promises to transform our feelings. Our feelings will be up and down and helter-skelter as long as we live, because you cannot find any stability in your emotions. And it's not in your feelings that you'll find the certainty you're looking for. We're also in a black and white culture. We expect answers. We expect to know, and we don't like living with uncertainty. That's why we love science and technology, because it gives us clear-cut answers a lot of the time. We love statistics because they tell us how many people fry their eggs one way and how many people fry them the other way. No doubt about it, black and white, straightforward. And sometimes God deliberately leaves us in uncertainty. That's the whole point of the book of Job, isn't it? Satan comes to God and says, I like the look of this guy Job that you've made. See how, what a servant of yours he is. But I'll bet that if you threw real hardship into his life, he wouldn't follow you. He'd curse you. And so God puts Job through trials. And some incomprehensible things happen to him. And his friends try to tell him that this must be because of some sin he's committed. And he knows that's not true. He just doesn't understand what's going on. And at the end of the book, Satan has lost. Job has not simply stayed faithful to God, but through his experiences, he's become stronger. And the interesting thing is, at the end of the book, God appears. And you think, ah, now we get the answers. This is a bit where Agatha Christie ties up the plot in the final chapter. And you know what? God doesn't give any answers. All he says to Job is, well, you can't understand it, can you? Because you weren't there when I created the universe. You don't know how I run it. You don't know how the universe sticks together. How should you expect to understand the things I'm doing with your life? And Job says, you're right. You're absolutely right, God. And it's through the uncertainty, through the not having answers, sometimes, that we come through to the biggest experiences in our life, that we know the reality of God best, in the darkness, not in the light. That we change into a stronger and firmer and more resolute character. And that's part of God's plan for us. And we've got to recognize that too. We're also in a push-button culture. We expect answers now. We expect all the problems in a soap opera to be sorted out in 30-minute slots. And if there's a really big one, it might go over the week of episodes. If it's something like Coronation Street, they might leave it hanging over till the next Monday. But basically, we expect plots to move on, solutions to come very quickly. Life is not like that. And sometimes God will leave us with problems for a while, simply because that's good for us. And we've got to be prepared to live that way. So the thinking of our culture doesn't necessarily help us understand the way God works, but he's caring and he's loving all the same. How about the big one? We ought to get there. In times of suffering. I think the question of the problem of evil is actually two different kinds of problem, and we need to look at them both. First of all, there's a logical problem. There are people who think they can prove that there cannot be a loving God in charge of the universe. And they would say, it's impossible. Here's my reasoning. You can't find a flaw in the argument. It's watertight. Therefore, there is no loving God. But there's a weaker version as well, which you could call the evidence problem. And those are the people who wouldn't say, well, it's not impossible that there might be a God, but it's incredibly improbable when you look at the amount of evil in the world. And I think there's a third area left over as well, because once you've sorted those two problems as well, there's also a separate question about random, purposeless evil. Because you can find answers to the logical problem and the evidence problem by looking at the things that do have a purpose, evil that has some kind of meaning behind it. But there is also a lot of gratuitous evil in the universe, things that go wrong when they don't seem to have to. There doesn't seem to be any plan or any purpose behind it, and you have to look at that as well. Okay, let's look at all three very quickly. First of all, the logical problem. The logical problem goes like this. One, God is supposed to be all-powerful. Two, God is supposed to be good, caring, and loving. Three, evil exists. And so the logical problem says those three facts don't fit together. If God is good, then he would remove the evil. So he can't be all-powerful. If God is all-powerful, he could certainly remove the good, but he doesn't. Therefore, he can't be good. You can't have a God who's both good and powerful, all good and all-powerful, and evil in the world. Therefore, you can have a weakened God if you want, And some people go for that. There's a great book written by Rabbi Harold Kushner called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And it goes for the solution that God cares, God hurts, God really grieves when things go wrong in the world, but ultimately God can't do anything about it. That's one solution. Or you can say, there is no caring God in the world. God is all-powerful, but he doesn't care about us. As Shakespeare put it in King Lear, as flies to wanton boys are we to the gods. They kill us for their sport. So you can have a powerful God, or you can have a good God, but you can't have both. Now, that seems like a pretty insoluble problem to start with, and certainly my middle fifth group at the moment are most hung up on it. But there are some questions you can ask. I want to give you three. Can God do anything? Is that what Christians believe about God? Second, would a good God automatically remove all evil? Third, if God is just, will he always seem to be? Now, I'll tell you straight away, I think the answer to all of those questions is no. But the interesting thing is, why is it no? So I'd like the people towards the front here to do some thinking about the first one. Can God do anything? And if the answer is no, he can't, then what happens to omnipotence? What are we talking about there? People at the back, have a minute just to think about, would a good God automatically remove all people? That's you at the back over that side, okay? And you people in the middle block, if you could look at the third one. If God is just, will he always seem to be? Have a think about that, and then let's see what we've got to say about it. Okay, on we go. Okay, that's not long enough to think in any depth, but it's enough to get our minds stimulated. So let's halt it there because time is ticking by, and let's just see. Can God do anything? I'm suggesting the answer to that is no. Does that make me a heretic, or could you see reasons why a Christian might say God can't do anything? People down here?
We think you're a heretic.
You think? That's fine. I'll sort you out later on. Okay. Ah. Right, absolutely, because the book of Hebrews says that, doesn't it? Twice in Hebrews 6, you read that God cannot lie, and God cannot swear by anyone greater than himself. So God cannot appears twice there, and it's something that's against his character. God can't lie because he's ultimate reliable, he's truth, I am who I am, and so there's a limit on God. Is there any other limit on God? True, if God has limited himself in some way so that he's given us an area of freedom that allows us to operate, then there are certain things he cannot do without taking that free will away. That's certainly true, and we'll come on to that one in a moment. The other thing is that God cannot do what's logically contradictory. God doesn't go around making squared circles. God can't make 2 and 2 equal 5 because God is not the author of confusion. And so there are some things that God cannot do. And that's very important when you get to this problem, because clearly God cannot make a world in which there is freedom and also in which he dictates the results. So that's very important. Okay, so when you say God can do anything, you have to be very, very careful what you mean. How about the people at the back? Would a good God automatically remove all evil? Why on earth would he leave evil around? Did you see any answers for that? I'm sorry? Free will comes into it again. In what way? True. If you're giving people the freedom to go the right way or the wrong way, then if you start zapping them every time they go the wrong way, people are going to get the message very quickly, and nobody's going to have any freedom any longer. We mustn't do that, or God will fry us within the next 10 seconds. That's not a good way to run a universe if you want people to be really free. That's absolutely true. Anything else? Any more thoughts? Right, absolutely. That is another important issue, isn't it? If you start getting rid of evil, where do you stop? I was listening to a tape preparing for this on which somebody said, you know, I was thinking about the Pennsylvania bombing, Timothy McVeigh, when people were saying, where is God? Why did God allow that to happen? Terrible thing, loss of life, evil in the world. Why doesn't God stamp it out? He said, I was thinking, how many people were actually committing adultery when that bomb went off? They were causing pain to their partners and their families. They were wreaking havoc. It's an evil thing. They were going back on their commitments. Would you want God to act on that as well? And we tend to be pretty selective about the evil that we want God to deal with. And evil that started by us. Well, that's okay. That's all right. And if God starts acting on evil, then we're all in trouble. I think also as well, sometimes you leave evil there because it's less than if you took it away. If you took wasps or mosquitoes out of the ecosystem, life would be a little bit more pleasant for us for a while. But then the loss of those things from the total system would have catastrophic effects on how long we'd live, on the way the ecosystem worked, on all sorts of other insects and bugs who would then become much more unpleasant than the other one. There are lots of other things. And if you take away one of those things, a lot more goes with it. I remember when David McNee, an evangelical Christian, became the head of the Metropolitan Police. And people said, ah, now we'll see prostitution cleared up in London. No more girls on the streets. Now we'll see, because this guy, he's a moral bloke and he's going to sort it out. And to their surprise and distress, the prostitutes stayed there. And McNee said, I'm not going to take them off the streets. Because I know if I do, it'll just go underground. It'll still be going on. It's the oldest profession, people say. It'll still be there because people are sinners. It'll just be that I can't keep an eye on what's actually happening. I want it above ground where I can see it. It's not the ideal situation, but better to have that evil happening than just drive it somewhere else where it's going to do more harm. So sometimes you have to live with evil for a while, don't you? Because if you didn't, something worse would happen. Okay, let's take the third one. If God is just, will he always seem to be? How do we do with that in the middle block?
First is, as you said with Job, God's going to the end and saying, you don't know how it will work.
We don't always know the answers, absolutely.
You don't see how God's dealing with things.
Exactly.
And the second is, as you said with free choice, thing, God comes out just 10 seconds later. There's a delay and leads it to a final judgment at the end.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And that's the point, isn't it? Outside time, if there is a God of eternity, outside time, there may be a completely different framework. There's a really interesting passage in the book of Ecclesiastes where the writer says, I saw in the place of justice, wickedness was there. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. And he said, I thought, what is God doing? And he came up with two answers. One is, God leaves the wickedness there to teach us so that we realize how fragile we are. Who knows, he says, if the spirit of man rises up and the spirit of the animal goes down into the ground. But God leaves evil in the world so that we'll think about just how little and how little we can do. And the other one, which is coming back to what Luke was just saying there, is that he says, there will be a time for all these things. This is chapter 3, where he's just been talking about, you know, that little poem in Ecclesiastes, there's a time for love and a time for hate and a time for life and a time for death, a time for mending, a time for throwing away. And he talks about all the different times that there are in life. And so his reasoning is, there's got to be a time for justice as well. And if we don't see it within the world in which we live, within the box in which we pass our existence, then justice must be outside the box. It happens somewhere else at some other time. And if you believe in an eternal God, if you believe that this life is not all there is, then it's possible that the ultimate justice of this universe won't actually be seen in operation in our lives here and now. And God will not always seem to be just. There's so much more you could say about that. So there are lots of answers there, and we haven't been through them all by any means, but those are the kinds of things that you could say about that. Let's look very quickly at the evidence problem, and I promise you we'll leave it at that, because we're not going to get onto hell tonight. We'd just be here all night if we did. Okay, let's look at the evidence problem, though, very, very quickly. The evidence problem is the way of looking at it that just says, yes, okay, so there might technically be a case to be made for a loving God, but when you look at all of the evil there is in the world, how can you say that there could be a God? Well, let me just whiz through this, and I won't give you an exercise to do at this point because we'll just get through it. There's one little question you could ask on this one to start with, which is, how much evil is too much? When you say there is so much evil in the world, how can we work out how much evil is consistent with a universe run by a good God? I mean, if you give people freedom, if you allow evil into your system, how much is too much? How much could a God of goodness actually live with? We just don't know. We don't have the equipment to judge. We know he is going to judge it. We know it's going to happen one of these days. We know that God is tender-hearted. He doesn't want anybody to suffer. He wants us all to turn from our wickedness and live. And the long-suffering of God, says the New Testament, is supposed to lead us to repentance. He delays, he delays, he delays. He gives human beings every possible chance to sort themselves out. Now, while he's doing that, evil is going on. How much evil must he tolerate before he says enough is enough and the final judgment comes? We just don't know. So that's one answer. But there are three classic answers as well that you need to know about. And they alliterate. There's the sin answer, which is that much of the evil in the world is actually our fault. You can't look at lots of the things that go on and blame God for them because we did them. When, for example, thousands of villages in Bangladesh get flooded every year and people lose their lives, people say, it happens all the time. What is God playing at? Why is he doing this? Well, God isn't the one who's cutting down the rainforests at the foot of the Himalayas and preventing the barrier that used to prevent the avalanches of the snows melting from the top of the Himalayas, sweeping down across the plain and deluging people in Bangladesh. We're the ones that cut down the trees because we want to make money. And until we do something about it, we are causing most of the problems in the world for ourselves. So there's a sin answer. A lot of it is human responsibility, not God's. The second answer is the science answer, what's sometimes called the natural law defense. God has made a universe in which things follow predictable courses. If I let go of this remote now, which I'm not going to, don't worry, I know it costs money, but if I did that, it would descend to the floor. It wouldn't kind of wiggle around and fly about a bit and then go down to the floor gracefully. It would just go straight down, because that's what gravity does. If I released it and it floated up to the ceiling and stuck there, you'd think, interesting. Because we can count on natural law. We can count on scientific results being the same time after time after time. That's how we know things. Because when you do an experiment, you can do it 5 or 6 times and always get the same result. And I can try it because I don't believe your results, and I will get the same result as well. And so what you've just experimented with becomes an established fact of science because it's repeatable. Because you can do the experiment over and over again, and those natural laws mean you always get the same result. And that's what makes life livable. If you had to get up in the morning and think, I wonder which way the force of gravity will be going today. You know, when I step outside the front door, will I blast it up to Mars, or will my feet remain on the Earth? You wouldn't go out much in the morning, would you, really? And it's only because of natural laws operating in that consistent way that we can live life. But here's the problem. When natural laws do work in that way, we are going to run up against them from time to time. If you jump over Beachy Head, God is not going to turn the rocks at the bottom into candy floss to give you a safe landing. If you take up smoking, every cigarette's going to take 3 minutes off your life. That's the way it works. It's not God that's shortening your life, it's you. And it's the natural law, it's the effect of nicotine upon your system. That's what's causing you the damage. And so God's natural laws can sometimes collide with people who are exercising the free choices in a way that produces pain and suffering and evil. Wouldn't happen in a perfect world, but then this is a sinful one. And the third one, this is the third S, is soul making. And people make the point, which has already been made tonight, that sometimes God puts us through experiences that are hard and tough because it's good for us, because it's something that we need. And even the worst experiences in life can be useful. I won't show you the whole of this, but there's an amazing bloke in Australia called Nick Vujicic. And he is somebody who was born for no reason that anybody could ever scientifically determine without any arms or legs. He grew up very bitter at God until he was 15 years old. And then he started to realize that God might have a purpose even through his suffering. This is him. And Vujicic is the most amazing evangelist. And when he goes on in that tape to talk about the countries he's reaching because of his disability, the lives he's affected, the way that he's changed life for so many people right around the world, he sees that although he still doesn't understand it, God has used the condition he was born with in the most incredible, powerful and satisfying way that could happen. Okay, there's one other issue that we ought to talk about, just, and that's random purposeless evil. You might say, okay, well, I can buy all of this. I can see that God can bring a purpose out of some things. But there are some things which just have no point whatsoever. Christopher Hitchens, for instance, who wrote a book about God being evil, talks about when he was in Vietnam and he was taken to a clinic where he was shown one half of a pair of Siamese twins, the successful half, the half they had managed to save and give a life back to. And he said, I really wish I hadn't accepted their offer to go around the rest of the premises. Why? Because upstairs, tied to a bedpost, kicking and thrashing about, just wasting its time with no brain, no purpose and no point, was the other half, the unsuccessful Siamese twin. It was ghastly, it was horrible, it was misshapen. And he said, what kind of God allows this kind of thing to happen? Now, to be fair, later in the article, he admits that this happened because of the US use of Agent Orange, the chemical that destroyed so many lives in Vietnam, created so many abortive and misshapen babies. And so he admits, honestly, in the end, it's not the Creator, it's what we've done with his creation. But it's a question, isn't it? You see, sometimes that look so evil, you've got to say, there can't be a God of love, can there? There's no point that you can bring out of this one. Well, Tim Keller, preacher I mentioned this morning, had something to say about that. Do you really know it is?